talking about. He leaned closer, and I melted. Tamsin, I know I'm not what you came here for. I honestly don't know how you put up with me. But ever since I met you, I've just felt like my world can be so much bigger than I ever dreamed. And I've always dreamed pretty big things for myself, you know. It's not like I've ever doubted my abilities or anything. Other people might have, but with my natural Jago, anyway, like I was saying, I thought I had a handle on everything I needed to worry about in the future. And then you walked through my door, literally, and suddenly, all my big dreams just weren't big enough for Jago. I interrupted again. Be quiet. I wrapped my arms around him and kissed him deeply. After a brief jolt of surprise, he answered with the same intensity, wrapping one of his arms around my waist while his other entangled itself in my hair. Everything about him flooded my senses, the way he felt, tasted, smelled. It intoxicated me, leaving me heady and greedy for more. I'd wanted him last night, but now I felt like I needed him, like I couldn't go on if I didn't get more of him. Part of that was driven by the knowledge that very soon I wouldn't have him at all. Everything felt amplified. Last night, I'd known he liked me. Tonight, I knew he loved me, and that knowledge sent my own love and desire to endless heights. Tamsin, he said breathlessly, when I began unbuttoning his shirt. It's still like I told you. Not until I can provide more, Jago, I interrupted, looking down at him. We were lying together on the rug, with me pressed on top of him, and my skirts pushed up to my knees. You don't have to provide anything. Do you understand? You're perfect like you are. Now, if you've got some other real reason to back off, that's okay. I'm absolutely not going to force myself on you. But if you're stuck on some idea of needing to show what you can offer, then stop it. I love you. And that's all that's needed. This isn't some kind of deal you have to strike. His face grew radiant when I said I loved him. If he could have seen himself, he would have taken back his joke about not being mistaken for an angel. He cupped my face in his hands and said, "Maybe you're right. I could never strike a deal this amazing." I shook my head and started to stand up. If you're going to talk shop, then you can go back to your own room after all. Whoa, hey. He stood too, encircling my waist before I could get far. I'm crazy about you, but I'm not crazy. He jerked me to him, and we kissed again. Then we were kissing on the bed. And then everything melted into a delirious blur, the joy in my heart mingling with the passion in my body, until I lost track of where one ended and one began. All I knew was that afterward, as he stroked my hair while I lay exhausted against his bare chest, I couldn't remember the last time I'd felt so completely and selfishly happy. And also, so sad. I curled my fingers into his chest, still drinking him in with all my senses. I tried to choke back a sob, but he noticed and shifted so that his face was near mine. The fire had died down by now, leaving scant lighting. He brushed his fingers against my cheek. What's wrong? Did I do something? No. No. I pressed a light kiss to his lips. You were perfect. Everything was perfect. I'm just happy. That's all. It's all... tonight. It's just a lot. Even though I couldn't see his face, I could sense him trying to puzzle that out. He eased himself back down again, keeping me close. After a long time, he said, "You know, after the way things ended at our first meeting, I never expected this is where I'd end up." I couldn't help but laugh, despite my quaking heart. "And yet, here you are." He laughed too, and kissed my forehead. "Here I am." Jago fell asleep soon thereafter, but I stayed awake most of the night, tormented by my own thoughts, as well as the need to cling to this as long as I could. Had I been wrong to do this, knowing what was to come? Would this moment make being away from him easier, or just more agonizing? And did I have to be away from him? It wasn't too late to change things. I've always dreamed pretty big things for myself, you know. It's not like I've ever doubted my abilities or anything. No, I wasn't going to change things. We'd have this memory, and those of our other times together, and that would be it. We each had our own agendas to follow, and those agendas couldn't work together. Maybe if we'd had more time, we could have figured something out. But it wasn't to be. I had a few remaining hours, though, so I fought sleep, savoring them as long as I could. I drifted off a little before dawn, only to wake soon thereafter as Jago was creeping from the bed. "I didn't mean to wake you," he whispered. "I'm glad you did." He got dressed in the dark and then returned to me. We sat together for a few minutes more, saying little, kissing a lot. At last, he stood up with a sigh. "You're hard to stay away from, Tamsin Wright. Be careful out there," I told him. "Avoid any blizzards. I'll see what I can do." He leaned down and kissed me one more time, setting a small bundle of cloth into my arms. "I love you. Stay warm, and I'll see you soon." Jago left my room, leaving me sitting up in bed with my heart breaking. Even in the dark, I knew what he'd given me. I could tell by its softness and the way it smelled like him. The red scarf. I clutched it to me and lay back down, too heartsick for tears. In the week that followed, I tried not to think about Jago, but it was impossible. Everything reminded me of him, and it didn't help that everyone in the keep brought up his name for various reasons, always under the assumption he'd be back soon. I nodded along with them and tried to keep to myself, not that my thoughts were very good company during those days. I wrote letters and practiced riding with Orla's horses. I watched the horizon a lot, anxiously scanning for any signs of storms. None came, but 7 days after Jago and Gideon departed for Constancy, I was sitting on a small balcony on the keep's tallest floor when I saw a large, dark group of riders far down the road. As they approached, they materialized into wagons, sleds, and horses. Springing up from my perch, I ran downstairs, even though I knew it'd be a while before anyone made their way up the hill to us. At last, there was a commotion at the gates, and all of a sudden people were spilling into the keep's courtyards. I spied the sailors from the Grey Gull and Lieutenant Harper. Ikori, who'd aided him, returned as well, but they weren't whose arrival made me come running forward. All 19 of the other glittering court girls, as well as Miss Quincy, entered the courtyard, slowing to a halt as they gazed around their Ikori surroundings with a mix of apprehension and excitement. They wore the drab fashions of Constancy, but otherwise seemed well. For a moment, I did nothing. I just watched them, relieved and happy to see they were okay. "Tamsin!" I'd been spotted. And in moments, I was swarmed with hugs and greetings. "You did it," said Winifred, nearly squeezing the air out of me. "You really do get things done." The sight of their smiling faces lifted my flagging spirits, and after they'd hugged me, I found myself hugging all of them. "You're okay?" I asked. "Everyone's okay?"
"We are now," said Damaris. She looked around, enthralled.
"This is amazing. I won't mind staying and exploring."
Vanessa shook her head.
"Not me. I'm ready for Cape Triumph."
Her eyes tracked a young Ikori woman passing by.
"But I wouldn't mind delaying for a clothing exchange. Look at that red tartan cloak. It's gorgeous. Maybe we could set up some trade."
"You will do no such thing."
"Hello, Tamsin." The sea of my friends parted, and Dinah Cole stepped forward. Her eyes narrowed at me and made the wind on top of the fortress seem warm. I see that someone is still watching out for you. I pray it's the 6 glorious angels, and not the 6 wayward ones.
It's nice to see you too, I muttered as she walked away. Beyond her, I saw Samuel and Constance's general store owner, Bernard Glover, speaking together. Dinah joined them, and all three looked over at me, expressions cool.
Samuel and Mr. Glover have business in Cape Triumph, so it was useful for them to come along, Polly explained.
Does Dinah have business there too? I asked Riley. We're her business, said Winifred. It's unclear if we still need guardians, but they insist we have a respectable female chaperone.
Respectable, huh?
I eyed Dinah a moment longer, then put her out of my mind as I turned to my friends.
Well, no need for her right now. Come on, let me show you around. I've got everything ready for you. If there's something you need, let me know, and I'll make sure it gets taken care of.
As we turned to go inside, I heard a familiar voice calling my name. We waited as Gideon ran up to us, his handsome face drawn with worry.
Gideon, I'm glad you're back, I told him. Are you okay?
I tried to get to you right away, Gideon said. I'm so sorry. I know you must be wondering what happened to Jacob.
I froze up a moment. Then,
oh, yes, I'd meant to ask. Where is he?
Down in the city. Gideon shook his head, and a few of the other girls looked dismayed too.
It's not fair, really, said Vanessa. Mr. Robinson was so nice to us, helped us get packed and ready to come here.
And he helped us get passage too, right?
Asked Damaris. I nodded, forcing myself to keep a blank expression. What's happened? Is he okay?
He's fine, said Gideon, frowning. I think so. It's a long story, but there was an unexpected delay at the fort that held Jacob up. I can explain more later, but he's not with us yet.
Oh.
I clutched my hands to keep them from shaking.
That's unfortunate. I hope it's cleared up soon.
The others nodded in agreement, and Damaris said,
That lovely Lieutenant Harper said it will be. He was pretty angry about the mishap. Jacob's probably on his way here right now, added Gideon, as we resumed walking inside. I know he doesn't want to miss the trip. He'll be back here soon.
I'm sure you're right, I said. Now, we should have a tour before you settle in, so you know where everything is.
The girls twittered in agreement, but Winifred suddenly interjected.
Oh, I almost forgot, Tamsin.
Mr. Robinson wanted to make sure this got to you. She reached into her cloak and produced a folded sheet of paper. I didn't have to open it when I took it with shaking hands. I knew what it was. Olivia's drawing of our family.
Thank you, I said.
Winifred beamed.
Oh, I only carried it. He's the one that made sure it got rescued from the attic, so you can thank him when he gets here.
I gave her a shaky nod, and then began a cheerful tour of the keep, barely even aware of what I said as I walked around and smiled with my friends. On the inside, though, I wanted to curl up in a ball and block the world out, because I knew what the others didn't. Jago would not be back to Kerniel any time soon. In fact, we'd likely never see him again.
Chapter 27
It's just like waiting on the docks in Culver to sail to Adoria, isn't it?
Several girls chuckled at Polly's observation. A bitter wind whipped around us, tugging at hair and cloaks. On the East Sister, barges and boats rocked near the bank as Ikori loaded crates and shouted orders. An overseer paced around with her list, directing each item and person to its place. The weight and size of all the objects and passengers had been taken into consideration and arranged into a precise plan.
I don't know. This wind puts me more in mind of the tempest, noted Maria.
No one laughed at that. Today wasn't a stormy day. Gusty, yes, but nothing out of the ordinary for late winter. Nonetheless, there was enough wind to make the boat sway more than they would have from current alone, and it was hard not to fixate on that.
but the wind only made ripples on the East Sister, not massive, ship-swallowing waves. And even if a boat did capsize here, the bank was in sight, just like when we rode the Quistimac. The perils of the journey had been on my mind, and in the last couple of days, I'd made a point of speaking to every girl individually to ensure there'd be no repeats of the panic some had experienced before sailing with the Balanquins. Most were comfortable with another water journey, or at least they claimed to be. I'd appointed Damaris and a few others to counsel anyone who might get cold feet. They all wanted to get back to Cape Triumph, but the storm still haunted us. "Good morning, ladies," came Lieutenant Harper's cheery voice. He tipped his hat at us as he and a few of his men passed by. The gloom of Maria's remark dissipated into smiles and greetings among my friends.
"I wouldn't mind being a soldier's wife," said Damaris, speculatively.
Vanessa frowned.
"He is rather striking, but I don't think they make much money."
"The officers do, don't they?" Damaris insisted.
"The very high-ranking ones, I'm sure," said Winifred.
"But he's still young." A dreamy look fell over Damaris.
"Young and gorgeous. As long as he can afford the contract fee, I could stand living humbly for a while if it meant waking up to that each morning."
Gasps and giggles met her remark, both because of its brazenness and because it was coming from normally level-headed Damaris. But living humbly struck my heart like a dart, made worse by the sight of Lieutenant Harper. The unexpected delay of Jago's that Gideon had spoken about upon arriving at Kerneil had been Harper's doing. Actually, Orla and I had conceived of it, and he'd implemented it, with some misgivings. Shortly after arriving in Constancy, Harper had made arrangements for one of his colleagues to bring Jago to the fort for questioning, on the grounds that they needed to go through the formalities of answering the heir's accusations of him kidnapping me. Harper had kept his involvement secret and had supposedly made quite a scene, insisting it was a waste of time to detain Jago when he'd already been cleared. But they'd taken Jago anyway. Harper had assured Orla that Jago wouldn't face any harm or punishment. He would just be delayed for days, put off, and seriously inconvenienced. By the time Harper's colleagues got around to conducting the brief interview, it'd be too late for Jago to join us. It was an elegant solution, and Harper, who didn't even know the plot's purpose, had agreed to it only after some coaxing and dealing with Orla. Orla had declared it all nice and neat, but my heart was in ruins. I was sick with the thought of what we'd done to Jago. He'd be devastated when he learned the delay had cost him the first trip south, and when he found out I was the reason for that delay. Well, I had to keep stopping my mind from going there. I kept thinking of when Harry had rejected me, and I'd gone through the heart-searing pain of being betrayed by someone you love. And now, I had just inflicted that same pain on another. The overseer yelled something in a quarry and looked around in annoyance to see why no one was acting. Her eyes fell on my group, and she beckoned us over. Using a mix of Ikori and Osfridian, she ordered us to three different boats. We split up accordingly and made our way on board. The Ikori barges, I'd been told, were smaller versions of the great beasts that the Balanquins used on the Heart's Blood. They were rectangular in shape, with their front ends tapering to a point and slightly raised off the water. The rest of each barge was flat and had a long canopy stretching over it that was held up by narrow poles coming up from the craft's sides. Sturdy, 3-foot-high railings lined the sides to keep everything in, but ropes were also lashed across the cargo as extra precaution. 10 rowers sat together in the back, and what looked like a giant set of oars was set into the very front. I learned that those basically functioned as the rudder and were used to steer. My barge's captain directed me and 6 other girls to a spot under the canopy and told us not to leave our places while sailing. More of the glittering court rowed in a barge tied next to ours, and the remainder in one a little farther down the bank. The heirs rowed together in the same boat, without any of us, which suited everyone fine. Except, perhaps, Dinah. Samuel had begun to read from one of the scriptures once they were seated, and though the other heirs listened with bowed heads, Dinah kept peeking up. I suspected she was searching for Gideon, and her grimace proved I was right when he came scrambling onto our barge just before departure. Her gaze then slid to me. Its chill made the frosty morning air feel balmy in comparison. Seeing Gideon, the other girl sitting around me straightened up and went back into coquette mode, except for Damaris, who still watched Harper wistfully. He was in the heir's boat, also at Orla's request, to make sure our chaperones didn't cross any lines, particularly with me. Gresham's laws had left me clear of any wrongdoing, but the heir's narrowed eyes and stiff words showed they felt otherwise. Gideon greeted us all warmly and settled down beside me. Taking in my solemn air, he asked, "Thinking about Jacob?" I flinched. "Ah, well, don't worry. They'll clear that up. It's a shame after all he did for us, but he'll get in on the next trip and be in Denham faster than you'd imagine." But not fast enough, I thought. Euros willing, I'd be married before ever crossing Jago Robinson's path again. He'd forget about me and move on to dizzying success. I kept telling myself that over and over, but it didn't lessen the pain I'd felt every day since parting from him. Mary's absence was a constant ache too, but it was tempered with the knowledge that I'd have her back soon. That hole in my heart would heal up, but the one Jago had left wouldn't. Small, two-person scouting boats launched ahead of the barges. This part of the East Sister was wide and slow, and prone to chunks of ice in the winter. Farther south, into the foothills, the river narrowed and became faster. Ice rarely formed there, but the rapids presented other problems. I'd decided it was best my friends remain ignorant of that, though. The barges untied next, the captains carefully manoeuvring to keep our party within sight of one another, but also spaced apart enough to avoid collisions. Ikori on the bank cheered and called farewells, and I decided it really was a little like our departure from Osfrid. But once we were steady and moving on the tranquil river, there was little of the drama we had often felt in a giant ship with no land in sight. I didn't miss that drama. Several of the girls, saying nothing, endured our launch with gritted teeth and white knuckles. They watched every bit of ice in the river and winced if the barge moved too suddenly. But by mid-afternoon, most everyone began to relax. I know it's always warmer in the south, but one of the sailors was telling me that spring will be in full force when we reach Denham, Gideon remarked. No snow, everything green, one of the Ikori overheard and said it was true. Vanessa exhaled with happiness. I'm ready for that. I'm ready for a lot of things. In the days before our departure, I'd asked Damaris about Vanessa's atonement. She took it like a warrior, had been the response. Barely blinked an eye out there in the cold. But what about inside? I had insisted, confessing to the town. Damaris's smile had faded. She got through it, without crying, and I got through it without choking someone. So, it's over and done. Of course, it hadn't exactly been over and done, because Winifred had later told me that when my disappearance had been discovered, Damaris had joked that Dinah should have to wear a carelessness sign for poor planning. Dinah had overheard, and Damaris had spent another sleepless night blackening and cleaning out the stove. All that's behind us now, I thought, leaning against a tarp-covered crate. The heirs might be our escorts, but they have no more power over us. Damaris and Vanessa will be the pampered wives of powerful men and forget any of this ever happened. Just before midday, one of the scouts returned upriver to tell us the way ahead was blocked with ice. The captain slowed all the barges, save one. It glided ahead of the rest of us, and the Ikori on board scurried about on some unseen task. By the time the rest of the barges crept ahead, that lone one had attached a large, square device made of wood and metal to its bow. We'd seen lots of ice chunks in the river today, but this particular bend was clogged with them, and in some places, those chunks had frozen together in thick barriers. My barge pulled toward the bank a good distance behind the ice and waited, as did the other barge. The one with the ploughing device pushed forward into a spot of the ice barrier that looked the least stable. As it did, some of the smaller boats joined it, and their riders began hacking at the ice with picks. Slowly, enough of the ice wall broke away for our whole party to make it through, and we continued on cautiously. Three more times that day, we had to wait for the ice to clear. One of the Ikori told me we could expect the same for a few more days. As a passenger, I had the luxury of just sitting around, but as the hours went by, I wished I could do something more productive. I even offered to row, but the Ikori captain chuckled and told me I was too short. My friends and I made up games and shared stories, and sometimes we found ourselves lulled into the passing river's hypnotic effect. We stopped when twilight came, for fear of missing obstacles in the dark. The spot was one well known to the Ikori, and the fact that we'd reached it today, as hoped, indicated we were on schedule. The bank was wide and clear, with room to build fires and set up tents. It felt good to walk on steady ground, to simply be able to walk for any length of time after being restricted to our small space. We reunited with the other Glittering Court girls around a fire, and everyone's spirits were high as we ate dinner. Restless, I wandered around afterward, investigating the rest of the camp. I passed Captain Milford, sitting with some of his sailors, and he held a canteen up to me in a dramatic toast.
"Well done, girl."
The barges were secured and guarded for the night, but a handful of Ikori were working on something at the river's edge. I made my way over, stepping carefully where the bank sloped. "Don't mind me," I said, when one spotted me. "Just curious." He waved me over and demonstrated how they were setting up fish traps for the night. Some were little more than netting, others were cages of woven sticks. The Ikori seemed to like my interest and showed me the clever doors on the traps that allowed fish to come in but made it difficult for them to get out. One was in the middle of explaining how the traps were baited when his eyes lifted to something behind me. He stopped talking, and I turned around. Orla stood at the top of the slope, watching with a smile. In a leather coat and pants, she looked very much as she had at our first meeting, only cleaner.
"Tamsin," she called, "come join me."
One didn't turn down that kind of request around here, so I climbed back up the bank. We walked through the camp, and Ikori paused in their work to greet her, some nodding or bowing. I was known by many too, and received my own share of well wishes. The scope of our party was incredible. There had to be at least 100 people.
"How are you doing?" she asked.
I shrugged. "Surviving, like always. Lieutenant Harper insists Jigo will be fine. No one will mistreat him. He should be released later today." "Oh, I know they won't hurt him. Harper's a good man. That, and Jago will probably walk out of that fort with a dozen deals in place from soldiers wanting to buy cornmeal and ribbons."
"Maybe he'll thank you," she said, though her rueful expression told me she knew better. I sighed.
"It won't take him long to figure out the detainment wasn't an accident. It won't take him long to figure out I was part of it. And that, oh, it kills me, thinking of how he'll feel the moment he realizes I betrayed him. I've been there. It's awful. It's like someone has your heart in their fist and is squeezing every last bit of blood from it. And yet, I almost feel just as bad about the other part."
Orla's brows knit in puzzlement.
Which other part?
Because this sounds plenty bad. I stared off ahead of me, the people and their movement blurring into the background. The part before he finds out, when he's still detained. He's in there now, knowing what day it is, knowing he's not with me. It must be devastating. And I bet he's fool enough to be worried about me, worried that I think he's the one who cut out and ran. It kills me to think of that. It's almost easier thinking of him hating me once he realizes the truth. Orla came to a halt, not far from her tent. She rested a hand on my shoulder and said, Tamsin, I can't say for sure how it'll all fall out, but one thing I feel for certain. Jago Robinson will never, ever hate you. In the days that followed, I tried not to think about how I was getting farther from Jago. Instead, I focused on how I was getting closer to Mary. Always, always, she had been my driving force behind all my planning. And one morning, waking up to brilliant sunshine and melting snow, I decided I wasn't going to let heartache for a man overshadow those plans. I'd come to Adoria for a reason, and it was time I remembered that. My friends noticed my increase in energy. I hadn't been cold to them, but I had been distant since leaving Kerniel, mostly because I'd retreated into myself. But I needed to learn to be social and outgoing again. I looked for pleasure in the world and in others, and my friends' personas likewise bloomed as we planned for Cape Triumph. Gideon noticed the difference as well. A week into our trip down the river, I began opening up again, talking with him much as I used to. He surprised me with his curiosity about the Ikori and would explore the evening camps as much as I did. He really surprised me in his desire to understand the Ikori's religious beliefs. Oh, I'm not converting anytime soon, he said with a laugh when I asked about it. But if I'm going to really try to understand divine forces in the world, it seems to me I should learn how other people understand them. I found him one evening huddled together with two Ikori trappers and the children. The boy and girl, Aerok and Briga, often tailed Gideon, which wasn't unexpected. Children seemed to sense his affinity. Kneeling beside them, I watched as Gideon concentrated hard on rubbing a stick back and forth across a larger one held on the ground with his knee. A pile of kindling sat nearby. Sweat beaded on his forehead, and I couldn't help a small laugh. He stopped when he heard me. Are you laughing at me, Tamsin? No, I said, covering another laugh. Not exactly. I'm just perplexed, that's all. Shaking his head good-naturedly, he returned to his task, saying, I've never made a fire without flint. When they heard that, they said I had to learn. Apparently even these little ones can do it. I could have had this lit already, Aerok told me very seriously. He turned back to Gideon.
You're wasting time.
Gideon went back to his task and finally got a spark, though his hands paid the cost in blisters. He sat back and exhaled, watching with weary satisfaction as Briga quickly blew on the small flame and the trappers added sticks. How'd I do? He asked the children.
Not terrible, but you'd have to do better next time.
Briga scrambled to her feet and gave me a grin that was missing a front tooth.
I'll get some more kindling.
Gideon wiped his brow and pointed at me. Make her learn. I need a break. I already know how, I told him. They didn't have flint when you lived in the market district. Sure, but when money was tight, you had to get creative. It's been years, though, I admitted. Aha, said Gideon. Time to refresh your skills. One of the trappers nodded and handed me a stick. The Ikori method was slightly different than what I had been taught, but it was similar enough that I quickly understood. I was less quick in making the spark, though. I really was out of practice, so I couldn't help a whoop of triumph when I managed it at last, much sooner than Gideon had.
You could use more practice too, one of the trappers told me.
But that's not bad.
What about other outdoor skills? Are you as bad as he is?
I glanced between them all, puzzled. What types of outdoor skills?
It's part of a deal I made with Aerok and Briga, Gideon said. They asked me to teach them some conversions between Ikori script and our letters. They wanted to teach me something in return, so I agreed when they offered to show me some outdoor skills. I didn't realize I'd be handed over to some harder masters. No offense. The two trappers both grinned at that. What else are you supposed to learn? Just this so far. The others are a little impractical.
Briga put her hands on her hips.
No, they aren't. We could go out in the river right now and teach you to swim.
You can't swim either, I asked Gideon.
You say either, like these are things I would have done all the time in Osfrit.
Gideon looked at me suspiciously.
And I can't believe you were doing much swimming there, unless you were watching from the Ars River while they built that bridge.
No, no, but Pa sometimes got hired on for jobs out of town, and once he had one building a wall near a lake. We kids came with him for the summer, and that's when I learned to swim.
See? You have to learn, said Aerok.
It's not that cold.
Gideon eyed the river, which was rapidly getting lost in darkness. We passed ice this morning.
Leave him alone for the night, said one of the trappers, his eyes crinkling with laughter. He's worked hard and enjoys some nice company.
Thank you, said Gideon.
But, the man added, come back tomorrow and we'll show you how to carve a spear.
Gideon groaned. Later, as he and I took a meandering route back to the Asfridian tents, I said, I bet you never thought you'd have Ikori children teaching you to swim.
I am not swimming in that river, at least not on this trip. Check with me again in the middle of summer.
Still, you've made some Ikori friends. They seem to like you.
Aerok and Briga do. I think the others are just pleasantly tolerant. You, on the other hand...
I could sense Gideon's big smile, even if I couldn't make it out in the shadows.
They all adore you.
Me? Why?
Well, even if they don't know all the details, they know you played a part in helping Orla smooth things out with Grashund. And you were, what, blessed by their priestess or something?
Or something.
Then, of course, there's Jacob. You're his friend, and they really adore him.
Sounds like all my adoration just comes by association, I teased. I gazed around at the dancing fires and silhouettes moving about on nighttime business. But most of them are good people, and it's been eye-opening.
Agreed. That's why I've enjoyed getting to know them, even if it apparently requires manual labour. I may not have a congregation yet, but I've been making notes on what I've seen to write a sermon on. Let's see. Tolerance? Understanding? I'm trying to explain how we can find peace by learning about our so-called enemies because... How do I put it?
Because we'll find we probably have more in common with our enemies than we have differences. Laughing, he came to a halt not far from our friend's campfire.
See? You're doing it again. Just like I said, you take all these things jumping around in my head and hone them down into one efficient line.
You would have come up with it if you weren't so tired from making that fire. That was my third one tonight, actually. When we both stopped laughing at that, he continued, much more seriously. It's nice to be able to talk to you again, Tamsin. Really talk to you. I've missed our talks. I looked up into his kind eyes and smiled back.
Me too.
I'm glad we get to spend this time together before you go off and start your great spiritual revolution. He hesitated, uncertainty spreading over his features.
Yes. About that.
Tamsin, is that you? And Gideon?
Dinah rose up like an apparition from those gathered around the fire.
Finally! It's almost time to go to sleep. You shouldn't be wandering around with... them. Gideon, will you lead us in a prayer before bedtime?
Certainly,
he called back. None of them knew yet about his decision to leave the heirs, and so long as nothing went against his conscience,
he didn't mind going through the motions with them. Likewise, my friends and I were also going through the motions of adhering to Dinah's directives. She could do little to enforce them, and it was easier just to keep the peace sometimes. As he turned, I lightly touched his arm. "What else was it you were going to say?"
"Nothing," he said, gesturing me forward. "Come on, let's go."
Chapter 28. During the last few days of our journey south, I began to believe Adoria could be warm. That didn't mean I was warm yet. A chill still clung to the air in the evenings and early morning, but by noon, the clouds would burn off, letting the spring sun come out in full force. Green buds swelled on the trees, and I spied crocuses blooming on the banks. There was no trace of snow, though its memory lingered in the river. Its water level was running high from snow having melted here, and the Ikori often spoke about how the lands upriver tended to flood.
"Look how warm it is," said Briga.
She tossed her coat onto the barge's deck.
"We could swim in this for sure."
"It's a trick and you know it," Gideon responded. "The sun may be out, but that water's still freezing." Aerox stood at the barge's side, peering over the wall, which was almost as tall as he was. When he tried to touch the water, Damaris and I sprang forward as one and jerked him back.
"Have a care, child," she scolded. "Tumble over, and you'll make poor Gideon have to go in after all."
Gideon shot us affronted looks.
"What? Why me? You two are always bragging about what expert swimmers you are."
Damaris winked at me.
"Well, it's not easy swimming in dresses, and we figured you'd want to step forward and do the manly thing."
Gideon, feigning indignation, returned to the book he and Briga were looking at. She and her brother had started spending time on our barge this week, both because our group was novel and because Gideon was helping her understand Asphridian letters. The children were light enough that the barge captains didn't mind their moving from ship to ship. The older Ikori also approved of the lessons. They believed surviving the political turmoil of these times required understanding the language of those they were struggling with. Most Ikori children were taught to speak Asphridian, but rarely how to read or write it. My friends and I helped teach them sometimes, and it seemed impossible that only a year ago I'd been a student as well, learning place settings and political parties in a luxurious parlour that didn't feel like it could possibly be in the same world. Getting closer to Adelaide and Mira made me think of Blue Spring a lot and all the good times I'd had there. I'd been composing 1,000 apologies for Adelaide. None felt adequate, but I'd deliver all of them if it might give me a shot at forgiveness. Even if it didn't work, I just wanted to see my two best friends again, to drink in the sight of them and be happy that they were alive and well. Something told me Mira wouldn't be married yet. I could picture men being enchanted with her, but she viewed marriage even more pragmatically than I did and wouldn't be in any rush. But Adelaide, she was the diamond. If she wasn't married, the odds were very good that she'd be engaged. She'd have no shortage of options. The question would be if she could find someone who echoed her romantic nature. I hoped she could. Truly. And I also hoped that her someone wasn't one of the top candidates I'd culled from Esme's lists. While thinking of Adelaide and Mira filled me with warm affection, pondering my own prospects dragged me back to cool calculation. I so needed one of those ideal men to be available. Just one. I'd been going over their biographies in my head lately, reminding myself of every detail and how I could play to each man's personality. Between that and my other glittering court skills, I adamantly believed I could win someone. And if those men had been taken, well, that was an unsettling thought, but I'd deal with it like I always did. I'd get things done. I'd find someone else who'd take on a widow and stepdaughter, and then I'd transform into exactly what he was looking for. Honestly, that task wasn't nearly so daunting as the other one weighing me at all times. Forgetting Jago. No matter how rationally I plotted my strategy for Cape Triumph, Jago always lingered on the edge of my thoughts. Well, I deal with that too. In the long run, it didn't matter if I ached forever because of him. I didn't need to convince myself I was over him. Just my husband.
"Didn't you hear me?" exclaimed Damaris. "Get back over here!"
Briga was a diligent student, but Aeroch, being younger, often grew distracted. He had wandered back to the edge and was leaning over it again, ignoring Damaris. Pointing up, he exclaimed, "Look at the smoke!" Beyond the swathe of evergreens and maples, columns of black smoke rose into the sky.
"It must be another village," said Winifred, though she sounded uncertain.
We passed a number on the trip, sometimes stopping for brief trading. But this didn't seem like the kind of smoke that came from stoves or fireplaces. The Ikori didn't think so either. Instructions were shouted among the vessels, and with a bit of coordination, the fleet made an unplanned landing at the bank. Orla leapt out before her barge was secured, uncaring of splashing in ankle-deep water. She issued a few commands in her language, and within moments she had 24 Ikori assembled. Weapons drawn, they plunged into the woodlands. The rest of us waited apprehensively, and the remaining Ikori drew their weapons. The sailors and soldiers stood braced in tense, watchful poses as well. Gideon and Briga forgot their lessons. I watched at the side with Aeroch, my hands clenching the wooden rail. Everyone flinched when half of Orla's group burst back through the trees about 15 minutes later. They shouted something to one of the captains, and he quickly lifted the tarp covering his ship's boxes. One of the scouts called out to Lieutenant Harper's barge, spurring his men to action as they disembarked and ran upriver. The scout then hurried to my barge and looked right at me.
"Tamsin, right. Dara Orla says you know how to care for injuries."
A little. Racking my brain, I recalled a dinner in Kerniel when I'd fallen into conversation with one of Orla's advisors about childhood ailments, most of my knowledge coming from caring for Mary. The man beckoned.
"Then come."
Gideon was on his feet beside me.
"I'll go too."
We followed the Ikori back into the woods and immediately found a well-worn trail. The smell of smoke grew stronger as we travelled, and after a few twists and turns, the trail ended in a small collection of houses, or what was left of them. Those that weren't already reduced to ashes were wrapped in flames. The smoke was so thick here that it was hard to see, and bits of ash floating on the air only made matters worse. Ikori were in motion everywhere. Some searched the remains of houses. Others had formed a bucket brigade at a well and welcomed the addition of new containers that the scouts had retrieved from one of the barges. I recognized almost everyone here. The village was deserted. Mostly. Over in a clearing, upwind of the smoke, one of the trappers I knew was tending to 5 people. One sat upright, the others lay on their backs. I hurried over with 2 Ikori who'd also been recruited for first aid. One of the patients was a boy, maybe 11 or 12, and the others were adults, 3 men and 1 woman. The scouts had brought medical supplies from the barges, and I set to work on the boy. He had a few scrapes and lacerations that I cleaned, but as he coughed and tried to sit, it became clear that smoke inhalation was what had taken him down. "Easy, you're okay," I said, supporting his back. He didn't seem to understand Asphridian, but guessed my meaning. I handed him a canteen, and he nodded his thanks. Satisfied with him, I moved on to another, the woman. She suffered from similar issues, but had also burned her arm. With a small knife from the supplies, I cut away her blackened sleeve to assess the damage. The skin underneath was scaly and red, with a few blisters closer to her wrist. I wrapped it loosely with clean, wet cloth as a short-term fix. Depending on what the blisters did, she could need some kind of ointment, but I didn't know the extent of our medicines. I was treating a similar burn on one of the men when it struck me as odd that I was already on my 3rd patient. Where were my companions?
Looking up, I saw them both huddled over another man. As soon as I finished my work, I went over to join them. When I saw the pool of blood on their patient, I clamped a hand over my mouth to stop from screaming. The two healers spoke rapidly in their own language and were trying to stop the bleeding that came from a wound on his thigh. Though they worked together without pause, they also seemed to be having an argument. One kept pointing back toward the river, and the other shook her head adamantly. "What happened?" I asked, but neither heard me. "Shut," said a voice. The fifth patient, who appeared to be the least injured, watched the others work, his face filled with worry. He clutched his hand to his chest, and I gently pried it away. A long gash across his palm had stopped bleeding, and if he could avoid infection, it would be fine. He grimaced as I cleaned and wrapped the hand. That cut had come from a blade, and I was about to ask more when a sixth patient was brought over. He too had a bleeding wound in his upper arm. One of the other healers examined it and told me, "The bullets went through. Just stop the bleeding and wrap it." I hastened to obey while she called for two Ikori to help carry the other wounded man back to the river. The debate had apparently been whether to remove the bullet here or back there. Back there had won. "Who did this?" I asked as I bandaged the arm. The man looked me over, taking in my clothing and language.
"Osfridians attacked us. No provocation."
I paused a moment before continuing my work. "They wouldn't do that."
"I didn't shoot myself."
No, of course not. I'm sorry. Just that they respect the treaties. If it was them, they had a reason."
"Maybe just being caught," he said with a snort. "They didn't expect anyone to be here yet."
Seeing I didn't understand, he grudgingly added, "This is a summer hunting camp." An out-of-the-way target. Just like the farm encampment I'd heard about in Kerniel. Its damage had been monetary, since the farm was seasonal, and no one had been there to fight back. No one to examine the attackers more closely, and perhaps realize that they weren't, in fact, Asphridian. Peering around at the smoky, chaotic scene, I suddenly wondered if I'd stumbled into the aftermath of another Lorandian ploy. Before I could give it much more thought, the trapper and another of Orla's people dragged a new patient our way, but set him several feet from the others we tended. When I stood up to go to him, the trapper shook his head and spread a tartan over the man's face and body. I backed away, stunned by the horror of it. The world blurred around me briefly, and when things settled back, I noticed that Gideon was gone. He'd been near me when I first set to work. Scanning the small settlement, I saw that most of the fires had been extinguished. All that remained burning were a roundhouse and a larger, barn-like structure with two floors. Ikori were actively trying to put out both. A handful also stood around arguing. After a quick check of my patients, I went to investigate and found Gideon. "What's happening?" I asked. He pointed. "There's someone up there, in the loft, but Orla won't let anyone risk going in. He's a Spridian." "One of the attackers!" I exclaimed. I joined those looking up at the barn's highest window. I had to wait for a gap in the smoke before I could make out a pale man with sandy hair sitting in the window frame. He had a hand to his chest and a glassy look in his eyes as he struggled to keep them open. Once, he tried to rise, but the effort proved too great, and he slumped back down. His clothing suggested he was Asphridian, but he could just as easily be Lorandian. Orla's sharp voice rose up beside me as she faced off with one of her warriors. He gestured at the window, his expression frustrated as he spoke to her. Orla shook her head and issued an obvious rejection, cutting him off when he tried to argue again. The man gritted his teeth as he peered up at the window, and then at the progress of those putting out the fire. I touched Gideon's sleeve. "He's trapped by his injuries, not the fire. If he had the strength, he could jump out and probably survive from that height. Look, that half of the barn isn't burning yet." "It doesn't matter," said Gideon. "This side's almost done for. When it goes, it's going to take the rest of the building with it. Order's right to keep them out."
The warrior who'd argued with Orla stared up at the window with narrowed eyes, then studied the barn's large entrance, and then glanced toward Orla. He reminded me of Aeroch, assessing whether he could climb up the side of the boat without getting caught. I understood the warrior's urgency. Capturing the assailant could provide valuable information about the attacks. That, and having a Lorandian captive, would solidify the case Jago and I had made. But the warrior proved too loyal to Orla, and, though obviously upset about it, held his position. Above us, the wounded attacker attempted to stand again, and failed. I caught a flash of terror on his face, and then his head lolled to the side as he collapsed back down. A swathe of smoke briefly enveloped him, sending him into a coughing fit that gave me an unexpected flashback to sleepless nights with Mary. The Ikori around me wore impassive expressions, and I couldn't blame them. But pity welled up in me, despite the man's crimes. He was still a human being, and it was a hard thing to watch. Turning from the window, I spied a gap in the smoke below that gave me a glimpse inside the barn's doorway. The building appeared to be empty, and while flames raged in one side, the other was still intact, and I could see a ladder reaching up from the ground floor. The way was perfectly clear, only a little smoky. If someone just moved fast enough...
What? Tamsin? Tamsin!
Gideon's voice rang out after me as I raced through the barn's doorway. I heard people yelling behind me, and then my whole world became flames and smoke. The flames were still concentrated on the other side, but the smoke was more debilitating than I'd expected. Each breath made me nauseous, and the haze and my tears blocked my vision. But I made it to the ladder, relieved to see it too was untouched. I climbed up into the loft, which stretched over only a third of the barn's length. The fact that the hay on its floor hadn't caught fire was nothing short of an angelic miracle. A piece of ash blew into my eye, and I tried to rub it out, only driving it in further. I stumbled over to the window and knelt by the man, taking his hand. He groaned and rolled his head toward me. "It's okay," I told him. "I'm going to get you out of here." From the blank look in his eyes, I wasn't even sure he'd heard me. Either the smoke or his injury had driven him into shock. Then, licking his lips, he stammered, "Molly? No, my name's Tamsin. I'm going to help you. Can you stand?" I didn't need his answer to know he couldn't. The front of his shirt was soaked in blood, so dark and wet that I couldn't pinpoint where the exact injury was. The ladder would be safe for another few minutes, I was certain, but he wouldn't be climbing down it. I wasn't even sure if he'd be breathing in a few minutes.
"You look just like her," he muttered. "She always said whiskey'd be the end of me."
"I'm guessing a bullet was," I said, leaning over him to peer out. Orla and Simikori were gathered below, and upon seeing me, they began shouting, but I couldn't hear what they were saying. The man's head knocked against my arm, his eyes closed, and I gently shook him as I slid my arm under his arm. "Stay with me. What's your name?" When he didn't respond, I thought he might already be dead. Then, after more coughing,
"Robert."
"Okay, Robert, I'm going to need you to stand. We've still got a clear shot for that ladder and the front door. I know it'll hurt, but..." As I tried to get him to rise, a figure appeared in the barn's doorway downstairs, and suddenly Gideon was racing toward us. Covering his mouth, he climbed up and was soon beside us. "Tamsin, are you okay?"
"Gideon, you shouldn't have come. Never mind. Help me get him out."
Tears leaking from his eyes, Gideon put his arm under the man too. The attacker cried out in pain as we forced him to stand, and I murmured apologies over and over. A crash from below jerked my attention away, and I watched in horror as part of the burning side of the barn collapsed inward. Not only did it block our way out, it sent sparks and ash everywhere, igniting places that had been untouched.
"Back, back!"
I exclaimed. Half dragging the man, we retreated toward the window and crouched down as flames raced over the barn's lower floor.
"Tamsin, look!"
Gideon cried.
Outside, on the ground, our friend the trapper came hurrying up with a large bundled hide. Quickly, he and some other Ikori began unfolding it. Rubbing my eyes, I said, "Looks like you don't need to take the stairs after all. Robert? No, don't go."